According to our next guest, something has been going wrong on many college campuses in the last few years. Speakers are shouted down. Professors say they are walking on eggshells, eliminating controversial material from syllabi. Students, once the staunchest defenders of free speech, now see words and ideas as sources of danger. Rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide are rising on campus as well as nationally. How did all of this happen? First Amendment expert Greg Lukianoff looks at this cultural shift to explain the background behind the crisis in academia and to offer some reasonable solutions. The new book is The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. It is a great pleasure to welcome Greg Lukianoff to the roundtable this morning. Greg, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You co-authored this book with Jonathan Haidt, and I'm curious as to how the two of you came to this topic and wanted to attack it.
Well, it was interesting. I've been working on campuses defending free speech and academic freedom since about 2001, and I became friends with John partially because we have this kind of weird position in the culture wars. I'm a political liberal, but I defend people from all over the spectrum. He tries to get liberals and conservatives to better understand where they're coming from. So we had become friends before noticing this trend on campus. But around 2013, 2014, almost seemingly overnight, we went from the students being the absolute best constituency on campus for free speech, and that includes offensive speech, that includes controversial speech on campus, to being the ones that were demanding everything from new speech codes to disinvitations to safe spaces and microaggression policies, for example. And we were really wondering where this came from. So we ended up writing an article in 2015 talking about how increasingly students were using these kind of faulty medicalized reasons for justifying censorship. And we in our original article, we tried to point out how potentially detrimental some of the thinking could actually be for mental health outcomes. And we wrote the book partially because when the data came in, it was way, way worse than we thought it was going to be.
So give me a sense of the range of the problem, meaning are we seeing this on Ivy League campuses? Are we seeing this on state college campuses? Or are we seeing this across the board? Is this really having an impact in all halls of academia?
Well, the problems are very different depending on what kind of campus you're talking about. Now, definitely when it comes to the students themselves demanding, everything from disinvitations to new speech codes, we're seeing that more concentrated in the more elite campuses. And we do think that that's partially at least the product of some of the sort of, upper class parenting problems that we see.
Nicely put.
When you look on more... the two chapters we have on parenting are two of my favorite, and we think it's everything from overscheduling to even something as simple as lack of free play, that you are actually seeing really bad mental health outcomes for a lot of the kids that are coming in to college as freshmen. And we think part of this is that students are unwittingly disempowering their own students, creating a lack of locus of control, the psychological term, that is one of the reasons why we see these increases in anxiety and depression.
So obviously, I want to talk to you about some of the solutions that you talk about in the book. But how did we get here? What mm-hmm. brought us here? Do you think?
What we call it is we call these problems of progress in the book. We actually think that all things being equal, these are probably predictable but good problems to have. That essentially, when we can spend more time with our kids, we do. When we can be more protective of these of our kids, we are, unless someone actually points out that, by the way, there's a danger in taking it too far. We think that, social media, we see actually as in many ways like a technological heaven if you looked at it from the point of view of 1970. But of course, as we now know, one of the downsides of this massive, communication revolution is that we can form ourselves into echo chambers. Facebook and Twitter both pat us on the back, essentially, for being in echo chambers, and that's negative. But the scariest thing is we also see a strong correlation between how much teenagers use social media and outcomes as severe as suicide.
When you think about the problem, and this is interesting because you don't blame the students. You say they're under enormous pressure to perform, and nor do you think that the problems that are facing these kids are all in their heads. So,
no.
So where do you go with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, we at the end of the book, we try to offer as many solutions as possible. But the first thing we have to say is we want to hear from readers about different ideas. We thought of this as the beginning of a discussion. We're just trying to diagnose the problem. But everything from things as simple as, you know, having associations of parents who get together to allow more independence for their children, you know, to allow for things like free play and unstructured time could go a long way. We think gap years can help a lot. That can help give students that sense of sort of independence and autonomy that in some cases they come into school lacking, due partially in some cases to helicopter parenting. But we also think universities themselves can do a much better job of preparing students for the fact that when done correctly, an education is going to be at times emotionally and cognitively difficult, that it's going to be challenging. And I think that sometimes people tend to throw up their hands like there's nothing that could be done for higher education, when my argument is we've barely even started.
You mentioned that two of your favorite chapters in the book are those on parenting, and I'm interested because they're fascinating chapters. When it comes to the parents and their responsibilities and their role in this, what did you find?
Well, we went and talked to three different parenting experts. Erica Christakis, who's the author of a book called The Importance of Being Little, Julie Lithcott-Haynes, who wrote a book called How to Raise an Adult, and the famous free-range mom herself, Lenore Skenazy. And all of them said that parents are in a very well-intentioned effort to help and nurture their kids, and we're mostly talking about more sort of like elite college-bound type students. They're overscheduling them, and they're eliminating free time and play. And one thing that was really amazing to me while researching this, I mean, I'm a lawyer with a deep interest in psychology, but I didn't realize how strong the research was when it came to unstructured time. So when I look, I have two kids under three myself, and I look at the way my friends are actually raising their children. They're scheduled from 6 a.m. to when they go to bed at night.
Right.
And realizing that this actually goes against what the research actually says really conclusively was kind of a shock even to me.
And that doesn't end, right? I mean, your kids are three, but I don't have children, but I have nieces and nephews who range in age anywhere from 12 to soon to be 18. So I see this swath, but they don't have any time. They get up in the morning, they've got practice before school, and then after they're, you know, you're lucky if you catch them before 11 o'clock at night. And it just seems to me that once you release them into college and there is more unstructured time, well, God knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, and that's why you have to give it earlier, and that's one of the reasons why we recommend things like gap years. But of course, the worst kind of gap year would be essentially just a continuation of the helicopter sort of over parenting additional year. It has to be something where the goal of parents has to be to cultivate independence and a sense of autonomy. There's a wonderful book that I didn't get to include a mention of called Achtung Baby, about how Germany, a German society, particularly in the wake of totalitarianism, had a real commitment to free time for kids and to raise independently minded children, even though parents themselves found this difficult. And in a funny way, we should actually be looking to Germany in some ways to teach us to raise kids who are ready for life as free people.
That was Sarah Zasky, right? We had her on when that book came out.
Absolutely terrific book.
It is a terrific book, but it's interesting because you just made a great point in the sense that you don't want that gap year just to be an extension of what it already is. But what it already is seems to be that structured time. Like when I was a kid, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, it was school first. And then, you know, 15, 16, you start to get a part-time job. But that doesn't even seem to be the kids that I see now. Some, but not all, the work component isn't as important as either what looks good on the college application or the sports or whatever else may be going on.
Yeah. And this brings us to, you know, one of the reasons why we hate these really mocking terms like snowflake, for example. Like these things are insulting to these younger people.
Oh, I'm proud of it.
Who don't really have it easy. Like in a lot of cases, these students are sort of pointed like rockets, you know, towards the Princetons and the Stanfords and the Harvards, you know, treated like they have to be Yo-Yo Ma by the time they're 17. And meanwhile, so you end up having these people who they might be extremely good at academic habits, but when it comes to the intellectual habits that let you be, you know, a fully functioning adult, they haven't had a time or space to cultivate that. So in a lot of ways, none of this will work unless parents actually start to understand that some of these things where we had to figure out our problems on our own were essential. They weren't side efforts in our lives. They were actually essential to make us happy and functioning adults.
So what is the responsibility, if we take a step back, what is the responsibility of schools? What is the responsibility of high schools, grade schools in, for want of a better term, helping parents get through this?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that we repeat over and over again is that we have to stop teaching sort of the mental habits of anxious and depressed people and then being surprised when students are anxious and depressed. A big inspiration for the book and our way of looking at it is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is an approach by which you look, and it's one of the most successful interventions for anxiety and depression, but where you look at your own sort of exaggerated thoughts. You look at your catastrophizing, for example. You know, when something small happens and you just assume it's the end of the world. And everybody does this, but anxious and depressed people have more cognitive distortions, and the way to fight them is to fight back against them. But so, and how this applies to parenting is don't raise your kids like they're in constant danger. Don't raise their kids like as if getting, you know, a C will mean the end of the world. And you have to come together with your community to actually create an environment that allows kids to experiment, to fail, and to have a more realistic approximation of how they have it, how things are not in a constantly threatening.
The name of the book is The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. The book is fascinating, and it's really an amazing read, and I just highly recommend it to people who just want to figure out what's going on. Greg, thank you very much for sharing with us. It's very nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Again, the name of the book, The Coddling of the American Mind. Greg Lukianoff is the co-author along with Jonathan Haidt. It's published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.